listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Ever had that sinking feeling you were at the wrong place at the wrong time? We've all experienced that, instinctively realizing that trouble is just ahead. Today's show spotlights new titles about unlikely and unwilling protagonists drawn into terrifying situations. Forced to power their way through crisis after crisis, they have no choice but to ride out the tempest. Along the way, they must face foes who test their morals and their mettle. My guest today, Joseph Finder, is just out with Suspicion. His hero is an average guy who, with one innocent act, tumbles into turmoil. This show promises to be a wild ride, but one thriller lovers will enjoy. Fasten your seat belts as we turn to page one of the Book Report. When I found reader reviews with comments like, "Best bad guys ever," I knew Michael Corita's Those Who Wish Me Dead would be perfect for this edition of the Book Report. 13-year-old Jace Wilson witnesses a brutal murder. In the aftermath, he's plunged into a new life, issued a false identity, and hidden in a wilderness skills program for troubled teens. The plan is to get Jace off the grid while police find the two killers. The killers, known as the Blackwell brothers, are slaughtering anyone who get in their way as they search for Jace. Now, all that remains between them and the boy are Ethan and Allison Serban, who run the Wilderness Survival Program, Hannah Faber, who occupies a lonely fire tower lookout, and endless miles of desolate Montana mountains. The clock is ticking. The mountains are burning. And those who wish Jace Wilson dead are no longer far behind. Robert Petkoff narrates.
Thunder cracked and echoed back off the high stone walls and the water, sounding deeper and more dangerous down in the quarry than it would have up on the road. The wind had been blowing hard ever since he got out of school, and it was really gusting now, swirling stone dust, and out of the western sky advanced a pair of pure black clouds, trapped lightning flashing within them. Bad time to be in the water, Jace thought, and then he latched on to that idea because it gave him an excuse not to jump. Wayne Potter is not worth getting electrocuted over. And so he started back, was almost all the way to the hole in the fence before he stopped. Wayne Potter wasn't going away. Come Saturday, he'd be there with his brother, and they'd take Jace out to rooftop and watch him down his leg, and they'd laugh their butts off. Then Wayne would go back to school Monday and tell the story, assuming he hadn't called everyone first. Or worse yet, brought them to watch. What if he brought the girls? It was that idea that finally gave him some resolve. Jumping was frightening, but not jumping in front of the girls? That was scarier still, and the price was higher. "You'd better jump it," he said. "Come on, coward. Just go jump it." He walked back fast, because dawdling only allowed the fear to build, so he wanted to go quick, get it over and done so that he knew he could do it. Once that start had been achieved, the rest would be easy. Just a matter of adding height, that was all. He kicked his shoes off, then pulled his t-shirt and jeans off and left them in a pile on the rocks. As thunder boomed again, he squeezed his nose closed with his thumb and index finger. A baby thing, yes, but he was alone and didn't care, and then spoke again. Since he was holding his nose, his voice came out high and girlish. He took one last look at the water below, shut his eyes, bent at the knees, and sprang off the ledge. It wasn't much of a drop. For all of his worrying, it ended fast, and it ended pain-free, except, of course, for the jarring shock of cold water. He let himself sink to the bottom. Water didn't bother him in the least. He loved to swim, just didn't like to dive, and waited for the feel of smooth, cool stone. It didn't come. Instead, his foot touched something strange, an object that was somehow soft and hard at the same time, and he jerked back in fright, because whatever it was, it didn't belong. He opened his eyes, blinking against the sting of the water, and saw the dead man. He was sitting almost upright, his back against the stone, his legs stretched out in front of him, head tilted sideways like he was tired. Blonde hair floating in the current Jace had created, strands rising off the top of the dead man's head to dance in the dark water. His upper lip was curled like he was laughing at someone, a mean laugh, mocking, and Jace could see his teeth. There was a rope around his ankles, and it was attached to an old dumbbell. For a few seconds, Jace floated there above him, suspended not 5 feet away. Maybe it was because he was seeing it through the dim water, but he felt separated from the scene, felt as if the corpse down here had to be something imagined. It was only when he realized why the man's head was leaning to the side that the terror he should have felt initially overcame him. The man's throat was cut, leaving a gap so wide that water flowed through it like an open channel. At the sight, Jace began a frantic, clumsy churn back up. He was no more than 15 feet down, but still he was certain he wouldn't make the top, would drown down there, his body lying forever beside the other corpse.
We've just heard Those Who Wish Me Dead by Michael Corita. Joseph Finder is back on the Book Report, this time to speak about his new page-turner, Suspicion. Joseph has written 10 bestsellers, including Buried Secrets, which won the 2011 Strand Critics Award for Best Novel, and Killer Instinct, winner of the International Thriller Writers Award for Best Novel of 2006. Born in Chicago, Joseph spent his early years living around the world, including Afghanistan and the Philippines. In fact, Joe's first language was Farsi, which he spoke as a child. Joe majored in Russian studies at Yale, where he also sang in the school's legendary a cappella group, the Whiffenpoofs. He likes to boast that he sang next to Ella Fitzgerald, an honorary Whiffenpoof. Joe went Phi Beta Kappa at Yale, then completed a master's degree at Harvard Russian Research Center, and later taught on the Harvard faculty. He was recruited to the CIA, but eventually decided he preferred writing fiction. Lucky for us. Joseph, thanks so much for joining us again on the Book Report.
Thanks for having me.
Suspicion's main character, Danny Goodman, gets in a waft of trouble very early on in the book. Introduce us to the story.
Right. Danny is a struggling writer living in Boston, and he's a biographer. He's got an agent who's pressuring him. He's got a publisher who's pressuring him, and he's not making any money. And he has a daughter who goes to a very expensive private school in Boston, which he cannot afford. So she pleads with him to sort of keep him in the school, but he doesn't have the money for it. And one day, a fellow parent at the school hears about the problem and offers him a loan of $50,000 to cover the tuition. Of course, Danny accepts it. That is the decision that turns his life upside down. So in some ways, it's like you know, one of the Alfred Hitchcock movies where you take an ordinary person and put them in extraordinary situations.
Right. Well, Danny's a writer, and you're a writer. Does Danny have some of your DNA?
Yeah. Yeah, he really does. I mean, I sort of figured that if I made my hero a writer, I wouldn't have to do any research, you know. But, you know, there's a mystique to being a writer. People sort of think of it as a terrific job, which it is. But there are also stresses to it. And I wanted to show that side of the writing life with Danny. I wanted to show that if you don't deliver your book, you're not making your living. You're not making any money.
Right. Well, speaking of research, the book deals with Mexican drug cartels and their very deadly rivalries. How intensive was your research, and how did you carry it out?
Well, I had the basic idea, and I talked to a number of DEA agents, past and present. And what I end up doing is sort of kicking the tires of the idea. I'll sort of say to them, well, how would this happen, and how would that happen, and what would you do in this situation? I started with the basic idea of how would you recruit an informant? How would you recruit someone like Danny Goodman as an informant? So, and I talked to people in the Boston DEA office. I talked to people who've been in the DEA all over the country, and that's basically my idea. Is that my principle is that I talking to the experts, I actually get seen ideas.
Speaking of confidential informants, are many of them coerced into doing this?
Not as often. No, not really. Not really. I mean, most informants are sort of recruited and they want to do it. There's a, you know, they do it for money or for ideology or, but usually they're not pressured into it. In my situation, they have there's a drug kingpin in Boston that the DEA wants to get the goods on, and they have finally someone who has a lead into him, who is Danny, and so they do pressure him.
Money laundering is central to the story. Can you hazard a guess as to the amount of cartel dollars that are actually churning through our financial institutions today?
I don't really know. I mean, there are a number of situations in which banks, like HSBC Bank, admitted to laundering money for the Mexican drug cartels. And there have been reports that the drug cartels own businesses in this country and use them to launder money. I think the DEA, the basic premise of the book is something that I speculated on, which is what would happen if a Mexican drug cartel decided to use an American money manager to manage their investments. You know, how would that work? And the people I talked to in the DEA all believe that's completely plausible. There's a law against transferring money out of the country. You know, if you transfer $10,000 or more, you have to file a form with the government. But it turns out there's no law against wiring money into the country. So that's what the drug cartels are doing.
We're speaking with Joseph Finder on the Book Report. A father-daughter relationship is at the core of the story. Did your daughter weigh in on the way you wrote the character of Abby?
Yeah, she did. She is now 20, but you know, when I was writing the book, she was a teenager, and she was going through the whole college application process, which high school kids have to do these days, which is a lot of pressure. I actually gave her the manuscript to read, and she went through it and edited it, and she would say, "Well, I wouldn't talk this way," and you know, my favorite book would be a Jodi Picoult book, and I borrowed a lot from her life.
Huh. I really congratulate you. I think you got the tension between teenagers and their parents right dead on.
Yeah. It is, you know, it's a very intense thing being a dad, and it's also a great thing. It also makes you, you know, you'll do anything to protect your kids, and that protective instinct is what gets Danny in trouble.
Right. Well, can we expect another Nick Heller book soon?
Yeah, I hope so. Actually, I was halfway through a Nick Heller book when I put it down to write Suspicion. I am most of the way through another standalone novel, but the one after that is going to be a Nick Heller book.
All right. In doing my research for this interview, I came across a video on your website, The Best Perfume in the World.
Yeah.
Why the fascination?
Well, I had a moment in one of my books, in Buried Secrets, in which Nick Heller gives an old girlfriend her favorite perfume, and I wanted it to be a perfume that is no longer made, that's really hard to get. And I actually just emailed one of the world's leading perfume experts just out of the blue, and I said, "Got any suggestions for what perfume this might be?" And he said, "Absolutely." And it turned out he lived in Boston, and we got together, and he gave me some of it, and I smelled it, and I said, "This is cool." And I put that into the story. I sort of like having real-life tidbits like that in my book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, any final thoughts on Suspicion?
No, I mean, Suspicion is a story of an ordinary person in a Hitchcock sort of sense who gets into extraordinary situations. And I think it's my most personal book. I think it's the one that I most closely identify with. And I, you know, we always like to think that our new book is the best one, but in this case, I actually do think that's true.
Well, readers, I have to say that I loved Suspicion. It was quite the page turner. Well, Joe, thank you so much for joining us. I loved the book.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's hear a sampling of Suspicion, performed by Stephen Kearney.
Danny felt his mouth go dry. She wants to cancel because I'm a few months late?
First, kiddo, it's not a few months. It's 15 months.
Okay, but...
You know how bad things are in the industry. Publishers are all freaking out about ebooks. They're looking for any excuse to cancel contracts these days.
Was there ever a time when things weren't bad in publishing? Mindy gave a quick rueful laugh, more a bark.
Louisa Peniman doesn't screw around.
This isn't just a threat? I mean, you think she's actually serious?
As cancer, Mindy said.
Then quickly she added,
Sorry, bad choice of words.
Mindy Levitin had gotten him a bigger advance for his biography of Jay Gould than he'd ever expected. It helped that his first book, The Kennedys of Boston, had been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, even though it didn't sell particularly well, or actually win the Pulitzer for that matter. Also, he had to admit that his proposal had been damn good. Even better was Mindy's pitch to publishers.
No one knows who Jay Gould is anymore, she'd written in her cover email. Yet no one had heard of some Olympic track star shot down in World War II, but Unbroken was a massive bestseller. Nor had anyone heard of a serial killer who menaced Chicago during the World's Fair, which didn't stop readers from buying The Devil in the White City. It's all in how the story is told.
And Danny knew how to tell the story. Jay Gould was a railroad speculator and a strikebreaker, and one of the richest men in America. An inside trader and a virtuoso at bribery. A scammer and a liar who actually bragged about being the most hated man in America. Random House, HarperCollins, and Simon & Schuster had all bid, but Louisa at Triangle had topped them all. The money sounded good at first, until you subtracted Mindy's 15% and spread the payments over the 3 years, at least, it would take him to write the book. Plus, a big chunk of the money wouldn't come in until the trade paperback was published, at least a year after the hardcover. Not that he was complaining. He got to do what he loved, and if he lived frugally and didn't go on any trips to the Caribbean, he could have made it. But then came the call from Sarah. His ex-wife had just gotten the results of a biopsy. There'd been no lump, nothing on a mammogram. Just a little warmth and redness in one breast she noticed one day. The skin felt different, hard and taut like an orange. Her lymph nodes were enlarged. Her doctor had told her it was probably an insect bite and he'd prescribed antibiotics. Her doctor was wrong. The survival rates for inflammatory breast cancer weren't great. She was a single mom, and she was frightened. One minute, Danny was researching the Great Southwest Railroad Strike of 1886, and the next, he was Googling estrogen receptors. Sarah's second husband had taken a job at a firm in Manhattan, and their eventual breakup had been acrimonious. And the guy was a jerk, as Sarah had finally come to realize. She needed Danny's help. He began eating a lot of cafeteria meals at the Dana-Farber Cancer Center. For the first time in years, his daughter actually seemed to need him around, too. She needed a steadying presence. She also needed someone to drive her to dance practice and play rehearsals and sleepovers. While he waited in the cramped back room of the dance studio, he researched chemotherapy and radiation and hyperthermia and raw apricot seeds and vitamin B17. And Jay Gould moved to the back burner. Because Mr. Gould, as fascinating as he wasn't as important as Danny's daughter or his ex-wife, whom he'd never stopped loving even when she stopped loving him.
Danny?
What?
I said we need to figure out what's next. How soon can you get me 100, 150 pages to see if we can keep them on the reservation and keep her from canceling?
You think that'll do it?
Might. Who knows? It's the only card I have to play. So you'll do it?
Danny wasn't even close to having a decent 100-plus pages, and he wouldn't be for at least a month. But if the book was canceled, there went his entire income stream.
That was Suspicion by Joseph Finder. Roxane Gay's An Untamed State has been called an assured debut, a novel of privilege in the face of crushing poverty and of the lawless anger that corrupt governments produce. Mireille Duval Jameson is living a fairy tale. The youngest daughter of one of Haiti's richest men, she has an adoring husband, a precocious infant son, and by all appearances, a perfect life. The fairy tale ends when she's kidnapped in broad daylight by a gang of armed men. Held captive by a man who calls himself the commander, Murray waits for her father to pay her ransom. As it becomes clear her father intends to resist the kidnappers, she must endure the torments of a man who resents everything she represents. The talented Robin Miles brings the novel to life with a very nuanced performance.
Once upon a time, in a far-off land, I was kidnapped by a gang of fearless yet terrified young men with so much impossible hope beating inside their bodies, it burned their very skin and strengthened their will right through their bones. They held me captive for 13 days. They wanted to break me. It was not personal. I was not broken. This is what I tell myself. It was hot, nearly 100 degrees. The air so thick it felt like warm rain. I dressed my son, Christophe, in a pair of miniature red board shorts and a light blue t-shirt with a sailboat across the front. I covered his smooth brown arms and his beaming face with sunscreen. I kissed his nose and brushed his thick, dirty blonde curls away from his face as he pressed his palms against my cheeks and shouted, "Mama, Mama, Mama." My husband, Michael, the baby, and I said goodbye to my parents, told them we would be back in time for dinner. Michael and I were taking Christophe to the ocean for the first time. We were going to hold him in the warm, salt water as he wiggled his toes and kicked his chubby legs. We were going to throw him toward the sun and catch him safely in our arms. My mother smiled from the balcony where she watered her plants, wearing a crisp linen outfit and high heels. She blew a kiss to her grandson. She reminded us to be safe. We put our son into his car seat. We handed him his favorite stuffed animal, a little bulldog named Baba. He clenched his beloved toy tightly in his little fist, still smiling. He has his father's temperament. He's usually happy. That is important to me. Before getting into the car, Michael double-checked that Christophe was strapped securely in his car seat. He put our beach bags into the trunk. Michael held my door open. When he closed it, he pressed his face against the window and blew air until his cheeks filled. I laughed and pressed my hand against his face through the glass. "I love you," I mouthed. I don't say those words often, but he knows. Michael ran around to his side of the car. After he slid behind the steering wheel and adjusted the rearview mirror so he could see the baby, he leaned into me and we kissed. He rested an arm on the armrest between us, and I idly brushed the golden wisps of hair on his arms. I smiled and rested my head on his shoulder. We drove down the long, steep hill of my parents' driveway and waited quietly for the heavy steel gates, the gates keeping us safe, to open. In the back seat, Christophe cooed softly, still smiling. As the gates closed behind us, three black Land Cruisers surrounded our car. The air filled with a high-pitched squealing and the smell of burning rubber. Michael's tanned knuckles turned white as he gripped the steering wheel and looked frantically for a way out. His body shook. The doors of all three trucks opened at the same time, and men we did not know spilled out, all limbs and gunmetal. There was silence, the air thin, still hot. My breath caught painfully in my ribcage. There was shouting. Two men stood behind our car, machine guns raised. Michael pressed his foot against the gas pedal to move forward, but a tall man with a red bandana across the lower half of his face, a man holding a machine gun, pounded his fist on the hood of the car. He left a small dent in the shape of his closed hand. He glared at us, then raised his gun, pointed it directly at Michael's chest. I threw my arm across Michael's body. It was a silly, impotent gesture. Michael's eyes were bright. The arcs of tears trembled along his lower eyelids. He grabbed my hand between both of his, held me so fiercely it felt like all those slender bones would be crushed. Two men slammed the butt of their rifles against the car windows. Their bodies glowed with anger. The glass cracked, fractures spreading. Michael and I pulled apart, waited tensely, and then the windshield broke, the sound loud and echoing. We covered our faces as shards of glass shattered around us, refracting sharp prisms of light. Michael and I reached for Christophe at the same time. The baby was still smiling, but his lips quivered, his eyes wide. My hands could not quite reach him.
We've just heard An Untamed State by Roxane Gay. Meg Gardner, an Edgar Award-winning author, is just out with Phantom Instinct. When shots ring out in a crowded L.A. club, bartender Harper Flynn watches helplessly as her boyfriend is gunned down. Then someone throws a Molotov cocktail and the club becomes engulfed in flames. L.A. Sheriff Deputy Aiden Garrison sees a gunman taking aim at Harper, but before he can help, a wall collapses, bringing the building down and badly injuring him. A year later, Harper is trying to rebuild her life. She's quit her job and gone back to college. Meanwhile, the investigation into the shootout has been closed. The men deemed responsible, two gunmen, were killed when the building collapsed. But Harper believes there is a third gunman, someone who escaped and is now targeting the survivors. Harper enlists Garrison's help. But the traumatic brain injury he suffered in that shootout has cut his career short and left him with a rare type of impairment, a face blindness that leads him to believe that random people are actually a single person changing disguises. As Harper and Aiden delve into the case, Harper realizes her presence during the attack was no coincidence. Her only ally is Garrison, who seems to see the same enemy everywhere he looks. Angela Brazil narrates.
When it started, Harper Flynn had a fifth of vodka in her hand, six shot glasses lined up on the bar in front of her, and a stinging cut on her arm from a broken beer bottle. Music rained through the refurbished warehouse, a sheet of noise. Harper poured the martini into a chilled glass. Down the crowded bar, a banker waved his empty highball glass and a 20. She nodded. McCallan, Nate, with Estella back. She'd get to him. She'd get to them all. 11 p.m., and she was halfway through her shift. She slid the martini glass toward the man in the suit. 14:50. He frowned and shouted over the band, "For an ounce of vodka and an olive?" She smiled. "For turning you into James Bond. And for not spitting in it." The dance floor was a swerving mass of spangled people. On the walls, flat screens projected glossy music videos. In booths and at tables along the balcony, cooler customers leaned back, holding court over bottles of Bollinger. The stage lights skewed the space between white glare and murky corners. The warehouse windows were milky with moonlight, pierced by occasional Los Angeles headlights. The suit stroked the stem of the martini glass. "I'll pay $4." "14:50," Harper said, still smiling, but both hands on the bar now. She wore a black cotton blouse, sleeves rolled to the elbows, and black jeans he couldn't see because he was too busy trying to Jedi mind trick her buttons open. Next to him, a woman leaned back, laughing. Hand to her chest. From the crowd, Drew appeared behind the suit. Eyes on Harper, shoulders square, as though he was lining up to headbutt the man. Drew leaned toward the guy's ear. "How's your drink?" The man looked up at him several inches, noticed the black shirt, the chilly eyes, the cornerback's body. Harper said, "His drink's about to be paid for." Maybe half a second, the guy held on, wanting to yank her chain again. Then he slapped $15 on the bar and skulked off. Drew smiled. "He thought I was your boss." That smile was wicked and overtly pleased. "Never," she said. "Not even when we play dress-up later on." He didn't work there. He only worked his way under her skin, into her thoughts, her days, her nights. Now he was laughing. She nodded at the far end of the bar and walked down. He followed. He slid her employee swipe card into her hand. "Thanks." She clipped the card to her belt, quietly, her back turned to the club's CCTV camera. "What's it like outside?"
"Zoo. Line around the block. Security's wanding guys and carding teenage girls."
"But they're still letting people in?" He raised his eyebrows. The walls seemed to bulge under the press of the crowd. Fire limit was 1,200. That many seemed to be clamoring for drinks. Harper said, "Your sister's not out there, is she?" He laughed.
"Piper might be able to fake her way past security, but she knows you're working. You're scarier than any bouncer."
"That's my motto. Now buy a drink and tip me big." Drew had borrowed her swipe card so he could avoid the hassle of security at the front entrance when he came back in. He eyed the bottles arrayed behind her. She added, "And no, you may not challenge me to mix the worst drink possible. I will not serve you an antifreeze or a brain tumor."
"An old-fashioned," he said.
She wiped her hands on her apron. "Bourbon or rye?"
"What's the most old-fashioned?"
She set a glass on the bar. "You stir it for 18 minutes to muddle the drink." She dropped in a sugar cube, added Angostura bitters and water, and stirred with a spoon. That's how Al Capone demanded it.
We've just heard Phantom Instinct by Meg Gardner. Best-selling author Karen Slaughter sets Coptown in Atlanta, 1974. It's Kate Murphy's first day on the job, but it's a tumultuous one. The Atlanta Police Department is reeling after the murder of an officer. But the day has barely begun, and Kate suspects she's not cut out to be a cop. Her male uniform is too big. She can't really handle the gun, and she's rapidly learning the APD is not a place that welcomes women. Worse still, she'll be partnered with Maggie Lawson, a cop with her own axe to grind. It seems the department means to isolate Kate and Maggie from all the action, but the move backfires, and soon they are flung into the heart of it. Kathleen Early performs the book.
Jimmy knew the workings of a gun. The 25 slide was already racked, cartridge in the chamber. The trigger spring engaged the firing pin. The firing pin hit the primer. The primer ignited the gunpowder. The bullet flew from the chamber. The casing popped out of the ejection port. Don's head exploded. Jimmy's memory did no work to raise the image. The violence was etched into his corneas, back dropped every time he blinked. Jimmy was looking at Don, then he was looking at the gun, then he was looking at how the side of Don's face had distorted into the color and texture of a rotten piece of fruit. Click, click. The gun had jammed. Otherwise, Jimmy wouldn't be running down the street right now. He would be face down in an alley beside Don, condoms and cigarette butts and needles sticking to their skin. Gilmer Street, Cortland, Piedmont, three more blocks. His knee could hold out for three more blocks. Jimmy had never been on the business end of a firing gun. The flash was an explosion of starlight, millions of pinpricked pieces of sun lighting up the dark alley. His eardrums rang with the sound. His eyes stung from the cordite. At the same time, he felt the splash against his skin, like hot water, only he knew. It was blood and bone and pieces of flesh hitting his chest, his neck, his face. He tasted it on his tongue, crunched the bone between his teeth. Don Wesley's blood. Don Wesley's bone. He was blinded by it. When Jimmy was a kid, his mother used to make him take his sister to the pool. She was so little back then, her skinny, pale legs and arms poking out of her tiny suit, reminded Jimmy of a baby praying mantis. In the water, he'd cup his hands together, tell her he'd caught a bug. She was a girl, but she loved looking at bugs. She'd paddle over to see, and Jimmy would squeeze his hands together so the water would squirt into her face. She would scream and scream. Sometimes she would cry, but he'd still do it again the next time they were in the pool. Jimmy told himself it was all right because she kept falling for it. The problem wasn't that he was cruel. The problem was that she was stupid. Where was she now? Safe in bed, he hoped. Fast asleep, he prayed. She was on the job, too. His little sister, it wasn't safe. Jimmy could end up carrying her through the streets one day. He could be jostling her limp body, careening around the corner, his knee brushing the blacktop as the torn ligaments clashed like cymbals. Jimmy saw a glowing sign up ahead, a white field with a red cross in the center. Grady Hospital. He wanted to weep. He wanted to fall to the ground. But his burden would not lighten. If anything, dawn got heavier. The last 20 yards were the hardest of Jimmy's life. A group of black men were congregating under the sign. They were dressed in bright purples and greens. Their tight pants flared below the knee, showing a touch of white patent leather. Thick sideburns, pencil mustaches, gold rings on their fingers. Cadillacs parked a few feet away. The pimps were always in front of the hospital this time of morning. They smoked skinny cigars and watched the sun rise as they waited for their girls to get patched up for the morning rush hour. None of them offered to help the two bloody cops making their way toward the doors. They gawked. Their cigarillos stopped midair.
That was a sampling of Cop Town by Karen Slaughter. The Book Report loves James Lee Burke for his atmospheric Dave Robichaux thrillers. But this time, Burke is out with a standalone title, Wayfaring Stranger. It's 1934. When 16-year-old Weldon Avery Holland happens upon none other than Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow, right after one of their armed robberies. A confrontation with the outlaws ends as Weldon puts a bullet through the rear window of Clyde's car. 10 years later, Second Lieutenant Weldon Holland and his sergeant, Herschel Pine, escape death in the Battle of the Bulge. They find Rosita Lowenstein, a beautiful young woman, hiding in a deserted extermination camp. Weldon and Rosita fall in love and marry. With Herschel, they return to Texas to seek their fortunes. There, they meet oil man Roy Weishart, a former Marine aviator haunted with guilt for deserting his squadron leader over the South Pacific. And Roy's wife Clara, a vicious anti-Semite who seems determined to make Weldon and Rosita's life a nightmare. It will be Weldon's father, Texas lawman Hackberry Holland, and the legendary antics of Bonnie and Clyde that shape Weldon's plans for saving his family from the dark forces that lurk in peacetime America. Will Patton narrates.
Grandfather was sitting at the kitchen table, an encyclopedia open in front of him, his reading glasses on his nose. He deliberately stood in front of his headlights to make water so others could watch. I can't speak with authority about his thought process since I'm not inside the man's head, I replied. I picked up the German binoculars my uncle had brought back from the trenches and focused them on the car. There's a woman in the front seat. A second man and another woman are in back. They're passing a bottle around. Are they wets? I removed the binoculars from my eyes. If wets drive four-door cars. My first wife had a sense of humor like yours. The only time I ever saw her laugh was when she realized I developed shingles. I focused the binoculars back on the driver. I thought I had seen his face before. I heard Grandfather get up heavily from his chair. He was over 6.5 feet tall, and his ankles were swollen from hypertension and caused him to sway back and forth as though he were on board a ship. Sometimes he used a walking cane, sometimes not. One day he seemed to teeter on the edge of eternity. The next day he was ready to resume his old habits down at the saloon. He had gin roses in his cheeks and skin like a baby's and narrow eyes that were the palest blue I had ever seen. Sometimes his eyes did not go with his face or his voice. The intense light in them could make other men glance away. "Let's take a walk, Satchel," he said. "I wish you wouldn't call me that name. You've got a butt on you like a washtub." "There's a bullet hole in the rear window of the car," I said, looking through the binoculars again. "My butt doesn't resemble a washtub. I don't like you talking to me like that, Grandfather." "Wide butts and big hips run in the Holland family. That's just something to keep in mind as you get older. It's a family trait, not an insult. Would you marry a woman who looks like a sack of Irish potatoes?" He pulled open a kitchen drawer and removed a holstered revolver that was wrapped with the belt, the loops stuffed with brass shells. The revolver was the dull color of an old buffalo nickel. It had been converted long ago for cartridges, but the black powder tamping rod was still in place, fitted with a working hinge under the barrel. The top of the holster had been worn smooth and yellow along the edges of the leather. Six tiny notches had been filed along the base of the revolver's grips. Grandfather hung the belt from his shoulder and put on his Stetson. The brim was wilted, the crown sweat-stained a dark gray above the brim. He went out the screen door into the waning twilight. The windmill was ginning furiously, the stanchions trembling with energy, a thread of water coming from the spout, the tank crusted with dirt and dead insects and animal hair along the rims. "The moon looks like it was dipped in a teacup. I can't believe how we used to take the rain for granted," he said. "I think this land must be cursed." The air smelled of ash and dust and creosote and horse and cow manure that feathered in your hand if you picked it up. Dry lightning leaped through the heavens and died like somebody removing an oil lamp from the window of a darkened house. I thought I felt thunder course through the ground under my shoes. "Feel that?" I said, hoping to change Grandfather's mood and my own. "Don't get your hopes up. That's the Katy blowing down the line," he replied. "I'm sorry I made fun of your butt, Satch. I won't do it no more. Walk behind me till we know who's in that car." As we approached the tree line, the driver of the car walked out of the headlights and stood silhouetted against the glare, then got back in his car and started the engine and clanked the transmission into gear. The trees were so dry they made a sound like paper rustling when the wind blew through the canopy.
We've just heard Wayfaring Stranger by James Lee Burke. This one is topping the charts right now, and with very good reason. Mr. Mercedes is Stephen King's newest, and it's a page-turner. In the pre-dawn frigid hours, in a distressed Midwestern city, hundreds of desperate, unemployed people line up for a spot at a job fair. Without warning, a lone driver plows through the crowd in a stolen Mercedes, running over the innocent, backing up, and charging again. 8 people are killed, 15 are wounded. The killer escapes. Months later, in another part of town, retired cop Bill Hodges is still haunted by the unsolved crime. When he gets a crazed letter from someone who threatens an even more diabolical attack, Hodges wakes up from his depressed retirement, hell-bent on preventing another tragedy. Brady Hartfield lives with his alcoholic mother. He loved the feel of death under the wheels of the Mercedes, and he wants that rush again. Only Bill Hodges, with several unlikely allies, can apprehend the killer before he strikes again. Will Patton narrates.
A few cars were coming up the steep rise from Marlborough Street where Augie had gotten off the bus. They turned left into the vast empty plain of parking lot that would no doubt be full by daylight tomorrow. Still hours before the first annual city job fair opened its doors. None of the cars looked new. Their drivers parked, and from most of them, 3 or 4 job seekers emerged, heading toward the doors of the auditorium. Augie was no longer at the end of the line. It had almost reached the first switchback. "If I can get a job, I can get a sitter," she said. "But for tonight, me and Patty just gotta suck it up." The baby gave a croupy cough Augie didn't care for, stirred in the papoose and then settled again. At least the kid was bundled up. There were even tiny mittens on her hands. Kid survived worse, Augie told himself uneasily. He thought of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. Well, this one was great enough for him. 2 years ago, everything had been fine. He hadn't exactly been living large in the hood, but he had been making ends meet with a little left over at the end of most months. Now everything had turned to sh**. They had done something to the money. He didn't understand it. He'd been an office drone in the shipping department of Great Lakes Transport, and what he knew about was invoices and using a computer to route stuff by ship, train, and air. People will see me with a baby and think I'm irresponsible, Janice Cray fretted. I know it. I see it on their faces already. I saw it on yours. But what else could I do? Even if the girl down the street could stay all night, it would have cost $84. $84. I've got next month's rent put aside, and after that I'm skint. She smiled, and in the light of the parking lot's high-arc sodiums, Augie saw tears beading her eyelashes. I'm babbling. No need to apologize if that's what you're doing. The line had turned the first corner now and had arrived back at where Augie was standing. And the girl was right. He saw lots of people staring at the sleeping kid in the papoose. Oh, that's it, all right. I'm a single, unmarried mother with no job. I want to apologize to everyone for everything. She turned and looked at the banner posted above the rank of doors. 1,000 jobs guaranteed, it read. And below that, we stand with the people of our city. Mayor Ralph Kinzler. Sometimes I want to apologize for Columbine and 9/11 and Barry Bonds taking steroids. She uttered a semi-hysterical giggle. Sometimes I even want to apologize for the space shuttle exploding, and when that happened, I was still learning to walk. Don't worry, Augie told her. You'll be okay. It was just one of those things that you said. I wish it wasn't so damp, that's all. I've got her bundled up in case it was really cold, but this damp. She shook her head. We'll make it, though, won't we, Patty? She gave Augie a hopeless little smile. It just better not rain. It didn't, but the dampness increased until they could see fine droplets suspended in the light thrown by the arc sodiums. At some point, Augie realized that Janice Cray was asleep on her feet. She was hip-shot and slump-shouldered, with her hair hanging in dank wings around her face and her chin nearly on her breastbone. He looked at his watch and saw it was 2:45. 10 minutes later, Patty Cray awoke and started to cry. Her mother, her baby mama, Augie thought, gave a jerk, voiced a horse-like snort, raised her head and tried to pull the infant out of the papoose. At first, the kid wouldn't come. Her legs were stuck. Augie pitched in, holding the sides of the sling. As Patty emerged now wailing, he could see drops of water sparkling all over her tiny pink jacket and matching hat. She's hungry, Janice said. I can give her the breast, but she's also wet. I can feel it right through her pants. God, I can't change her in this. Look how foggy it's gotten. Augie wondered what comical deity had arranged for him to be the one in line behind her. He also wondered how in hell this woman was going to get through the rest of her life. All of it, not just the next 18 years or so when she would be responsible for the kid.
We've just heard Mr. Mercedes by Stephen King. Readers, I hope among these wrong place, wrong time thrillers, you found some right choices for your summer reading list. Still searching for what to read next? Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for ideas across top genres and authors. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.